Hello everybody, it's time for another episode of BitNote with David Collins, where we'll be playing video game music and talking about the games they're from. Hope you enjoy! So, I try to be an optimistic and positive person, so what better way to start the show with the wonderful end of the world?
She's a goddess with a plan at the end of the world. Got a puppet in her hand, she's a pulling the string. A marionette that gathers every little thing and follows every command and every little whim. Got a wonderful plan, gotta visit the world. Grab an arms full of everything good and true. Make a global out of junk, make a planet anew. If you wanna come along, she'll take you too.
And that was the title theme from The Wonderful End of the World by Digimon Games. The game apparently sets in a world where the entire world is going to be eaten by a mythological creature with the head of a fish. This is suboptimal. Instead of actually trying to save or prevent the world or prevent this from happening, apparently there's this, you play as this entity that goes around and tries to actually save everything in the world, sort of like the way you might like throw everything into a storage truck if a flood's going to destroy your house, and hopefully start up a new world somewhere else. It's a very nice premise that really doesn't play that much into the actual game, because the game's focus is really much its gameplay, which takes heavy inspiration from another game called Katamari Damacy, which the music of which I've played on this show before. Essentially, you start off as this creature, that's a small creature, very small, and you walk around in these various environments. As you pick up over small items, they get added to you, and the more small items you pick up, you grow. The higher you grow, the more items you can pick up, and in this way you create a snowball effect where you tend to grow higher and higher and bigger until you gradually grabbed up every single thing in the world. The difference It's pretty much the same thing as both in Katamari Damacy, which was hugely successful, although, you know, in its own niche way, and The Wonderful End of the World, where it seemed like the developers, a set of indie developers making this game available on PC computers as an indie game download, felt to just take the concept and run with it in their own direction, which is pretty similar to the original direction. It's kind of a fun gameplay mechanic, and it's a nice implementation of it as well. It's still fun when you're always trying to find items that are, you know, big enough so that they'll add to your size, but also small enough that you're able to grab them. And also the feeling as you grow bigger and bigger, where as you originally were on a small scale, and it seems like the level is changing as you grow bigger and bigger. All these aspects are very well represented and taken over from the game. It's kind of like when you're buying a different brand that's clearly taking inspiration from a big main brand, you know, but still is nice in its own way. In addition, it's also got The Wonderful End of the World has all got its own inspirations. There's one level, of course, pretty much every gamer remembers in that level called Arcadia, where as opposed to just going around and pick up random items, like items in a garden or in a living room or whatever, you're actually going around some abstract version of an arcade where you start off in a version of Pong and end up picking up the Pong ball and stuff and going into versions of Pac-Man, and then you find a bunch of people, cars racing around in a version of Tron. It's like all these like 80s arcade games, so in this great big, you know, mix-up, and then great tribute to it, and then you're going around just doing your thing, trying to absorb all of these, grow bigger and bigger to grow more stuff. It's kind of funny, as you grow bigger you see more of these references. But Wonderful End of the World is a fun little game, and maybe if it isn't quite the same high quality as the game is taking inspiration from, I still think it goes in an interesting direction. And of course, it's got great music as well. Now, I can't seem to find out who actually made these songs, which is kind of frustrating. The game doesn't really seem to have credits, even when you beat the game, and a couple of other methods I've tried to find out who wrote the songs have kind of gone flat. The best I could figure out was that the music seems to be made by some people called IB Audio, which seems to allow licensing of tracks. Now, that doesn't kind of make sense for the intro theme, where it seems to be very, very specific about the game and the music, so it's not like you could just license it out and go for it. However, the next bit of music I'm about to play from the game, the Megapolis theme, is actually a great piece of music, so maybe IB Audio provided that one. Alternatively, it's maybe the guys in Dejabon themselves actually created the music and they just didn't properly credit themselves. You know, it kind of helps if you do credit, by the way, guys. But congratulations if you're multi-talented. So the Megalopolis theme plays in the very last level of the game. It is the end of the world is close to nigh and you've basically got to go bigger and bigger and consume the entire city so that you can safely preserve it for the new world. There's a beautiful sunset, the music plays beautifully, and you say, you know, this is a pretty nice end of the world. Hope you enjoy.
Thank you.
And that was music from The Wonderful End of the World. All right, why don't we move the tempo up a little? How about music from a game where you shoot things? Yes, yes, I know, shooting tends to come up a lot in video games, but wait, this is different. This actually requires strategy, thinking, and a bit of intelligence, but also just has the visual action. I'm talking about the game Gain Ground by Sega. Now, this was originally released years and years ago, back in 1988. It was released for the arcades, and it was also released for Sega consoles such as the Mega Drive. Now, when this game was released, I had absolutely no clue it ever existed. And I was to continue not having a clue it existed for many, many years. But of course, Sega would, especially in the noughties, start releasing compilation packs. The two I remember specifically was one for the PSP version and another one on the Xbox. You know, a single game which would contain many classic Sega games. So I played it, and I played the classics of Sonic and Echo the Dolphin and ReStar and a few others that I'd heard of or maybe came across. And then I came across Gain Ground, and I had no idea what it was about. It just seemed, Gain Ground? What was that? So I started playing it, and I played a little more, and then just, I got it. I was just amazed. This is a game that actually looks very simplistic. You start the level. It's a top-down perspective. Your guys are at the bottom of the screen. There's a bunch of enemies scattered around the screen, and there's usually a goal at the top or middle or wherever the screen. You've got to get your guys to the goal, or you've got to kill all the enemies. And you start off with three guys, so you can either try to get all three of your guys through the gauntlet to the exit, or you can try to use those guys to kill off all the enemies. So it kind of sounds, oh, okay, you just shoot enemies, get through it, correct? But no, I started realizing there was a strategy. For a start, you weren't sure whether you had to destroy the enemies or not. Secondly, you know, each character had their own weapon type. You see, this takes place in a future where apparently mankind has lost. I actually don't get the plot, but it's something along the lines of, you know, we created this super realistic battle simulator so that mankind, which has lost its sense of war and time's tranquility, can learn to, I don't know, be more violent, I guess, or something. The idea was it would simulate all different types of, like, period and history and everything, and unfortunately the whole thing turned evil and started capturing people or something. I don't really know. But the whole point is that it's a setup where basically a bunch of warriors have to go through different times and different time periods and rescue their different comrades and fight together. And of course, all the comrades are from completely different timelines. So you've got like an American revolutionary, you've got some aboriginal person with a boomerang, you've got like this super high-tech, you know, guy from the future, and this guy who walks around really slowly with a rocket launcher. And that's really the whole point of this game. All of these characters have like different weapons, different abilities, but while they might be strong in one area, they can be really weak in another area. And for instance, one of the huge things is that a lot of the enemies are like on these pillars, and you have to try to shoot them, but you have to have a weapon that'll actually gain altitude and be able to strike upwards, or else you won't be able to get them at all. And so suddenly you have to realize, for each level, you have to choose which of your troops you're going to use, and you're going to have to strategically guide them towards the exit or destroy the enemies in the right sequence through all these different levels. And this is where it gets even more trickier. Each level, you usually have a comrade. You start with only three of your comrades, or your allies. But every so levels, there might be one or more comrades just standing there on the field. Just a small little item. And you have to get, if you want that comrade to join your ranks, you have to get your character over to that comrade, get him to join you, and then walk him all the way to the exit. And then and only then will you be able to use that specific character in subsequent levels. So obviously this gets suddenly a whole lot more complicated. I mean, you got to make sure you rescue all of these to build it up. But what happens if you've got a comrade that's really powerful, but like the enemies are kind of guarding him? I mean, what strategy do you use? And if there are two enemies, you've got to make sure that two of your characters can successfully get through the level so that you can pick them up, because you can only carry one comrade at a time. And of course, if one of your own characters gets hurt or killed in the level, suddenly they become a little icon on the screen, and you have to get one of your remaining characters to go grab him and bring him to the exit. So it's this whole thing about you've got a bunch of characters, and if they keep getting shot and die, then you can lose them all, but you can also pick them up in levels. So you've got to strategically go through all the levels, make sure you've got as many of your friends and comrades as possible, work together, and just basically build up this team and make sure you know which weapon to use and which level to try to decide whether to use your most powerful weapon but risk him getting damaged, or just use a weaker ally to damage the enemies and weaken them. And then if that enemy gets damaged, try to get another of your allies to go and grab that guy and bring him to the exit so he can... It's just, there's a lot of smart decisions. There's a lot of challenge in trying to make sure you've got the right troops, and that you don't lose the really ones with the powerful attacks, but the ones that might also be weak. And you've also tried to have to figure out which one to go. So Game Ground, definitely a great game. And I'll play the music, which is called Awakening, which is stage run music by Y Takada. It is from Game Ground by Sega. Enjoy. So it is time for the last music thing of the show. In a previous episode, I played the theme music of Max Payne, and I said how much I really liked that game. Its atmosphere, its music, its mood, and just basically it seemed like really have the guy on the edge, pushed to the limit, just trying to fight back at all the people who'd screwed his life over and just about managing to get through in the end. Well, that game did have a sequel. It also had a sequel of that, but I haven't really played it, and since it's made by a completely different development studio, I'm not sure I want it. But let's not get into my own sense of elitist game choices right now. The point is, Max Payne returned in Max Payne 2. The game I was nervous about, would it be as good as the previous one? I'd heard some bad, and it was. It was just, it took everything that was good about the previous game and just made it better. I mean, there was gunplay, it was slow motion gunplay, while a bit of a cliche that was introduced with the first Max Payne game, they really stretched it out. They had a whole physics engine so that, you know, shooting enemies in slow motion, they might fall over, crash into boxes, smash things over. Everything felt, that's pretty common these days, but it was pretty cool back then. And, there's also a great sense of humor, which can be dark, but also twisted and hilarious. Like, for instance, there's one really tough mob boss who ends up getting trapped in an explosive mascot suit, and you have to protect him from all these armed assailants. But it's not just that, though. They also really tugged on the emotional strings for this one by effectively giving Max Payne, like, someone, basically a new partner called Mona Sachs, who had previously appeared briefly in the previous game, but then disappeared, unfortunately, very quickly, possibly dead. It's actually, normally in a video game, video games are terrible with romance or any sort of love. They're terrible at attraction because it's just a bunch of stereotypes that happen to hook up for reasons. But I honestly think that the sudden relationship, the energy between Max Payne and Mona Sachs in this game is probably the best sort of like real chemistry I've ever seen in any video game. It's just the idea you get is that they're both kind of tortured, twisted people in a way, but with heart, and that they just happen to realize that they can't really do without each other, even though they try to pretend that they can't. And more realistically, it's just a whole lot of things are getting in their way. They're Russian mobs, cleaning company dressed as terrorists, gigantic criminal conspiracies, just all the standard stuff, you know? And it's just the fact that it seems that Mona seems to be working for some people who are kind of unscrupulous in the first place kind of puts a bit of a strain on whatever sort of relationship the two pair end up having. But I think in the end, there's a specific resolution to everything that I wasn't happy of, but I kind of accepted. And then by going online, I realized that I could actually change the ending just by repeating the game and completing it at higher difficulty levels. So I did, and I thought I got the ending that I thought Max deserved, and it's just amazing. So I think that in the whirlwind of emotions with this sort of game that's kind of poignant at times, I think the song that plays during the end credits is just really, really good. It's composed by Poets of the Fall, who I've played on this show before when I was playing the music of the other Red Indie game, Alan Wake. So I'll leave you with this song, which I think is pretty cool, and thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to listen to any podcasts or download previous episodes, you can do so at the Dublin South FM website at dublinsouthfm.ie. This has been David Collins with BitNote. Thank you for listening.
In a headlight, staring bleak, beer cans, deer's eyes on the asphalt, underneath our crushed plans and my lies. Lonely street signs, power lines, they keep on flashing, flashing by, flashing. And we keep driving into the night. It's a late goodbye, such a late goodbye. And we keep driving into the night. It's a late goodbye. Upon my cheek, and we cross that line. You made me strong.
it's a late goodbye. Your flame and hair and then playing hide and seek. I can't breathe easy here as our trails gone cold behind us. Till in the John Mirror you stare at yourself grown old and